fists and shoved him tumbling out into the daylight. Practicals began to pour through the broken doors, heavy sticks in their hands, eyes fierce above their masks.
"Arrest everyone!"
shouted Glockter over his shoulder, limping down the corridor as fast as he could, following Frost's broad back into the bowels of the building. Through an open door, Glockter saw a merchant in colourful robes, face covered with a sheen of sweat, as he desperately heaped documents onto a blazing fire.
"Seize him!" screamed Glockter.
A pair of practicals leapt past into the room and began clubbing the man with their sticks. He fell with a cry, upsetting a table and kicking over a pile of ledgers. Loose papers and bits of burning ash fluttered through the air as the sticks rose and fell. Glockter hurried on, crashes and cries spreading out into the building around him. The place was full of the smell of smoke and sweat and fear. The doors are all guarded, but Colt might have a secret means of escape. He's a slippery one. We must hope we are not too late. Curse this leg of mine. Not too late. Glockter gasped and winced in pain, tottering as someone clutched at his coat.
"Help me!" shrieked the man. "I am innocent!"
Blood on a plump face, fingers clutched at Glockter's clothes, threatening to drag him to the floor.
"Get him off me!"
shouted Glockter, beating at him weakly with his cane, clawing at the wall in his efforts to stay upright. One of the practicals leapt forward and clubbed the man across the back.
"I confess!"
the merchant whimpered as the stick rose again, then it cracked down on his head. The practical caught hold of his slumping body under the arms and dragged him back towards the door. Glockter hurried on, Lieutenant Jallenhorm wide-eyed at his shoulder. They reached a broad staircase, and Glockter eyed it with hatred. "My old enemies, always here ahead of me." He labored up as best he could, waving Practical Frost forward with his free hand. A baffled merchant was dragged past them and away, squawking something about his rights, heels kicking against the stairs. Glockter slipped and nearly fell on his face, but someone caught him by the elbow and kept him upright. It was Jallenhorm, a look of confusion still splattered across his heavy, honest face. So, big men have their uses, after all. The young officer helped him up the rest of the steps. Glockter did not have the energy to refuse him. Why bother? A man should know his limitations. There's nothing noble in falling on your face. I should know that. There was a large antechamber at the top of the stairs, richly decorated with a thick carpet and colourful hangings on the walls. Two guards stood before a large door with their swords drawn, dressed in the livery of the Guild of Mercers. Frost was facing them, hands rolled into white fists. Jallenhorm pulled out his own sword as he reached the landing, stepping forward to stand next to the albino. Glockter had to smile. The tongueless torturer and the flower of chivalry, an unlikely alliance.
"I have a warrant for Colt, signed by the king himself."
Glockter held out the paper so the guards could see it.
"The Mercers are finished. You have nothing to gain by getting in our way. Put up your swords. You have my word you will not be harmed."
The two guards glanced at each other uncertainly.
"Put them up!"
shouted Jallenhorm, edging a little closer.
"All right."
One of the men bent down and slid his sword along the boards. Frost caught it under one foot.
"And you," shouted Glockter to the other one, "now."
The guard obeyed, throwing his sword to the floor and putting up his hands. A moment later, Frost's fist crunched into the point of his jaw, knocking him cold and sending him crashing into the wall.
"But,"
shouted the first guard. Frost grabbed him by the shirt and flung him down the stairs. He turned over and over, banging on the steps, flopping to the bottom, lying still. I know what that feels like. Jallenhorm was standing motionless and blinking, his sword still raised.
"I thought you said..."
"Never mind about that. Frost, look for another way in."
"Ugh."
The albino padded away down the corridor, Glockter gave him a moment, then he edged forward and tried the door. The handle turned, much to his surprise, and the door swung open. The room was opulence itself, near as big as a barn. The carving on the high ceiling was caked in gold leaf. The spines of the books on the shelves were studded with precious stones. The monstrous furniture was polished to a mirror shine. All was oversized, over-embellished, over-expensive. But who needs taste when you have money? There were several big windows of the new design, large panes with little lead between them, offering a splendid view of the city, the bay, the ships within it. Magister Colt sat smiling at his vast gilt desk before the middle window in his fabulous robes of office, partly overshadowed by an enormous cabinet, the arms of the Honourable Guild of Mercers etched into its doors. Then he has not got away. I have him. Tied around the thick leg of the cabinet was a rope. Glockter followed it with his eyes as it snaked across the floor. The other end was tied around the Magister's neck. Ah, so he does have a means of escape after all.
Inquisitor Glockter!
Colt gave a squeaky, nervous laugh.
What a pleasure to finally meet you! I've been hearing all about your investigations.
His fingers twitched at the knot on the rope, making sure it was tied securely.
Is your collar too tight, Magister? Perhaps you should remove it.
Another squeak of merriment.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't intend to be answering any of your questions, thank you.
Out of the corner of his eye, Glockter saw a side door edging open. A big white hand appeared, fingers curling slowly around the doorframe. Frost. There is still hope of catching him, then. I must keep him talking.
There are no questions left to answer. We know it all.
Do you indeed?
Giggled the Magister. The albino edged silently into the room, keeping to the shadows near the wall, hidden from Colt by the bulk of the cabinet.
We know about Kaline, about your little arrangement.
Imbecile! We had no arrangement. He was far too honourable to be bought. He would never take a mark from me.
Then how?
Colt smiled a sick little smile.
Salt's secretary, he said, giggling again. Right under his nose. And yours too, cripple. Fool, fool. The secretary carried the messages. He saw the confession. He knew everything. I never trusted that smarmy shit. Kaline was loyal then.
Glockter shrugged.
We all make mistakes.
The Magister gave a withering sneer.
Mistakes? That's all you've made, dolt. The world is nothing like you think it is. You don't even know what side you're on. You don't even know what the sides are.
I am on the side of the king, and you are not. That is all I need to know.
Frost had made it to the cabinet and was pressed against it, pink eyes staring intently, trying to see round the corner without being seen.
Just a little longer, just a little further. You know nothing, cripple. Some small business with tax, some petty bribery, that's all we were guilty of.
And the trifling matter of 9 murders?
We had no choice, screamed Colt. We never had any choices. We had to pay the bankers. They loaned us the money, and we had to pay. We've been paying them for years. Valent and Bulk, the bloodsuckers. We gave them everything, but they always wanted more.
Valent and Bulk? Bankers?
Glockter threw an eye over the ridiculous opulence.
You seem to be keeping your head above water.
Seem, seem, all dust, all lies. The bankers own it all. They own us all. We owe them thousands, millions.
Colt giggled to himself.
But I don't suppose they'll ever get it now, will they?
No, I don't suppose they will.
Colt leaned across the desk, the rope hanging down and brushing the leather top.
"You want criminals, Glockter? You want traitors? Enemies of king and state? Look in the closed council. Look in the House of Questions. Look in the university. Look in the banks, Glockter."
He saw Frost edging round the cabinet no more than 4 strides away. His eyes went wide, and he started up from his chair.
"Get him!" screamed Glockter.
Frost sprang forward, lunged across the desk, caught hold of the flicking hem of Colt's robe of office as the Magister span round and hurled himself at the window.
"We have him!"
There was a sickening rip as the robe tore in Frost's white fist. Colt seemed frozen in space for a moment as all that expensive glass shattered around him, shards and splinters glittering through the air. Then he was gone. The rope snapped taut. Hissed Frost, glaring at the broken window.
"He jumped," gasped Jallanhorn, his mouth hanging open. "Clearly."
Glockter limped over to the desk and took the ripped strip of cloth from Frost's hands. Close up, it scarcely seemed magnificent at all, brightly coloured but badly woven.
"Who would have thought?" muttered Glockter to himself. "Poor quality."
He limped to the window and peered through the shattered hole. The head of the Honourable Guild of Mercers was swinging slowly back and forth 20 feet below, his torn, gold-embroidered gown flapping around him in the breeze.
"Cheap clothes and expensive windows. If the cloth had been stronger, we would have got him. If the window had more lead, we would have got him. Lives hinge on such chances."
Beneath him in the street, a horrified crowd was already gathering, pointing, babbling, staring up at the hanging body. A woman screamed.
Fear or excitement, they sound the same.
"Lieutenant, would you be so good as to go down and disperse that crowd? Then we can cut our friend loose and take him back with us."
Jallanhorn looked at him blankly.
"Dead or alive, the king's warrant must be served."
"Yes, of course."
The burly officer wiped sweat from his forehead and made, somewhat unsteadily, for the door. Glockter turned back to the window and peered down at the slowly swinging corpse. Magister Colt's last words echoed in his mind.
"Look in the closed council. Look in the House of Questions. Look in the university. Look in the banks, Glockter."
Chapter 22. 3 Signs. West crashed onto his arse, one of his steels skittering out of his hands and across the cobbles.
"That's a touch!" shouted Marshal Varouz. "A definite touch! Well fought, Giselle, well fought!"
West was starting to tire of losing. He was stronger than Giselle and taller, with a better reach, but the cocky little bastard was quick, damn quick, and getting quicker. He knew all of West's tricks now, more or less, and if he kept improving at this rate, he'd soon be beating him every time. Giselle knew it, too. He had a smile of infuriating smugness on his face as he offered his hand to West and helped him up from the ground.
"We're getting somewhere now."
Varouz slapped his stick against his leg in delight.
"We may even have ourselves a champion, eh, Major?"
"Very likely, sir," said West, rubbing at his elbow, bruised and throbbing from his fall.
He looked sidelong at Giselle, basking in the warmth of the Marshal's praise.
"But we must not grow complacent."
"No, sir," said Giselle emphatically.
"No, indeed," said Varouz. "Major West is a capable fencer, of course, and you are privileged to have him as a partner, but, well," and he grinned at West, "fencing is a young man's game, eh, Major?"
"Of course it is, sir," muttered West. "A young man's game."
"Bremer Dan Gorst, I expect, will be a different sort of opponent, as will the others at this year's contest. Less of the veteran's cunning, perhaps, but more of the vigor of youth, eh, West?"
West, at 30, was still feeling somewhat vigorous, but there was no purpose in arguing. He knew he'd never been the most gifted swordsman in the world.
"We have made great progress this past month, great progress. You have a chance, if you can maintain your focus. A definite chance. Well done. I will see you both tomorrow."
And the old marshal strutted from the sunny courtyard. West walked over to his fumbled steel lying on the cobbles by the wall. His side was still aching from the fall, and he had to bend awkwardly to get it.
"I have to be going myself,"
he grunted as he straightened up, trying to hide his discomfort as best he could.
"Important business?"
"Marshal Burr has asked to see me."
"Is it to be war, then?"
"Perhaps. I don't know."
West looked Giselle up and down. He was avoiding West's eye for some reason.
"And you? What have you got in mind for today?"
Giselle fiddled with his steels.
Nothing planned. Not really."
He glanced up furtively. For such a good card player, the man was a useless liar. West felt a niggling of worry.
"Ardy wouldn't be involved in your lack of plans, would she?"
The niggling became a cold throbbing.
"Well, maybe," snapped Giselle. "Well, yes."
West stepped right up to the younger man.
"Giselle," he heard himself saying slowly through gritted teeth, "I hope you're not planning to fuck my sister."
"Now look here."
The throbbing boiled over. West's hands gripped hold of Giselle by his shoulders.
"No, you look," he snarled. "I'll not have her trifled with, you understand? She's been hurt before, and I'll not see her hurt any more. Not by you, not by anyone. I won't stand for it. She's not one of your games, you hear me?"
"All right,"
said Giselle, face suddenly pale.
"All right, I've no designs on her. We're just friends is all. I like her. She doesn't know anyone here, and you can trust me. There's no harm in it." "Get off me!"
West realized he was squeezing Giselle's arms with all his strength. How had that happened? He'd only meant to have a quiet word, and now he'd gone way too far.
Hurt before. Damn it.
He should never have said that. He let go suddenly, drew back, swallowing his fury.
"I don't want you seeing her any more. Do you hear me? Now hold on, West. Who are you to—"
West's anger began to pulse again.
"Giselle," he growled, "I'm your friend, so I'm asking you."
He stepped forward again, closer than ever.
"And I'm her brother, so I'm warning you. Stay away. No good can come of it."
Giselle shrank back against the wall.
"All right. All right. She's your sister."
West turned and stalked towards the archway, rubbing the back of his neck, his head thumping. Lord Marshal Burr was sitting and staring out of the window when West arrived at his offices. A big, grim, beefy man with a thick brown beard and a simple uniform. West wondered how bad the news would be. If the Marshal's face was anything to go by, it was very bad indeed.
"Major West," he said, glaring up from under his heavy brows. "Thank you for coming."
"Of course, sir."
West noticed three roughly made wooden boxes on a table by the wall. Burr saw him looking at them.
"Gifts," he said sourly. "From our friend in the north, Berthod."
"Gifts?"
"For the king, it seems."
The marshal scowled and sucked at his teeth.
"Why don't you have a look at what he sent us, Major?"
West walked over to the table, reached out, and cautiously opened the lid of one of the boxes. An unpleasant smell flowed out, like well-rotted meat, but there was nothing inside but some brown dirt. He opened the next box. The smell was worse. More brown dirt, caked around the inside, and some hair, some strands of yellow hair. West swallowed, looked up at the frowning Lord Marshal.
"Is that all, sir?"
Burr snorted.
"If only. The rest we had to bury."
"Bury?" The Marshal picked up a sheet of paper from his desk.
Captain Silber, Captain Hoss, Colonel Aaronhorn. Those names mean anything to you?
West felt sick. That smell. It reminded him of Gurkle somehow, of the battlefield.
Colonel Aaronhorn, I know, he mumbled, staring at the three boxes. By reputation, he's commander of the garrison at Dunbreck.
Was, corrected Burr.
And the other two commanded small outposts nearby on the frontier.
The frontier? Mumbled West, but he already guessed what was coming.
Their heads, Major. The Northmen sent us their heads.
West swallowed, looking at the yellow hairs stuck to the inside of the box.
Three signs, they said, when it was time.
Burr got up from his chair and stood looking out of the window.
The outposts were nothing. Wooden buildings mostly, a palisade wall, ditches and so on, lightly manned. Little strategic importance. Dunbreck is another matter.
It commands the fords on the Whiteflow, said West numbly. The best way out of England.
Or in. A vital point. Considerable time and resources were spent on the defences there. The very latest designs were used, our finest architects. A garrison of 300 men, with stores of weapons and food to stand a year of siege. It was considered impregnable, the linchpin of our plans for the defense of the frontier.
Burr frowned, deep grooves appearing across the bridge of his nose.
Gone.
West's head had started hurting again.
When, sir? When is the question? It must have been at least 2 weeks ago for these gifts to have reached us. I am being called defeatist, said Burr sourly. But I guess that the Northmen are loose and that by now they have overrun half of Northern England. A mining community or two, several penal colonies, nothing so far of major importance, no towns to speak of. But they are coming, West, and fast, you may be sure of that. You don't send heads to your enemy, then wait politely for a reply.
What is being done?
Precious little. England is in uproar, of course. Lord Governor Mead is raising every man, determined to march out and beat Bethod on his own, the idiot. Varying reports place the Northmen anywhere and everywhere, with 1,000 men or 100,000. The ports are choked with civilians desperate to escape. Rumours are rife of spies and murderers loose in the country, and mobs seek out citizens with northern blood and beat them, rob them, or worse.
Put simply, it is chaos.
Meanwhile, we sit here on our fat arses waiting.
But weren't we warned? Didn't we know?
Of course! Burr threw his broad hand up in the air. But no one took it very seriously, would you believe? Damn painted savage stabs himself on the floor of the open council, challenges us before the king, and nothing is done. Government by committee, everyone pulling their own way. You can only react, never prepare.
The marshal coughed and burped, spat on the floor.
Ah, damn it, damn indigestion.
He sat back in his chair, rubbing his stomach unhappily. West hardly knew what to say.
"How do we proceed?" he mumbled.
"We've been ordered north immediately, meaning as soon as anyone can be bothered to supply me with men and arms. The king, meaning that drunkard Hoff, has commanded me to bring these Northmen to heel. 12 regiments of the king's own. 7 of foot and 5 of horse, to be fleshed out with levies from the aristocracy, and whatever the Anglanders haven't squandered before we get there.
West shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
That should be an overwhelming force.
Heh, grunted the marshal. It better be. It's everything we have, more or less.
And that worries me.
West frowned.
The Gosker, Major. We cannot fight the Gurkish and the Northmen both at once.
But surely, sir, the Gurkish, they wouldn't risk another war so soon. I thought it was all idle talk.
I hope so. I hope so.
Burr pushed some papers absently around his desk. But this new emperor, Usman, is not what we were expecting. He was the youngest son, but when he heard of his father's death, he had all his brothers strangled. Strangled them himself, some say. Usman ul-Dosht, they are calling him. Usman the Merciless. He has already declared his intention to recapture Dagoska. Empty talk, perhaps, perhaps not. Burr pursed his lips. He might even now be learning of our troubles in Angland, might even now be preparing to take advantage of our weakness. We must be done quickly with these Northmen, very quickly. 12 regiments and levies from the noblemen. And from that point of view, it could not be a worse time.
Sir?
This business with the Mercers. A bad business. Some of the big noblemen got stung. Brock, Isher, Barazin, and others. Now they're dragging their feet with the levies. Who knows what they'll send us, or when? Bunch of half-starved, unarmed beggars, probably. An excuse to clean the scrapings from their land. A useless crowd of extra mouths to feed and clothe and arm. And we're desperately short of good officers.
I have some good men in my battalion.
Burr twitched impatiently. Good men, yes. Honest men. Enthusiastic men. But not experienced. Most of those who fought in the south did not enjoy it. They have left the army and have no intention of returning. Have you seen how young the officers are these days? We're a damn finishing school. And now His Highness the Prince has expressed his interest in a command. He doesn't even know which end of a sword to hold, but he is set on glory, and I cannot refuse him.
Prince Reynold?
If only! Shouted Burr. Reynold might actually be of some use. It's Ladislaw I'm talking of, commanding a division. A man who spends 1,000 marks a month on clothes. His lack of discipline is notorious. I've heard it said that he's forced himself on more than one servant in the palace, but that the arch-lector was able to silence the girls.
Surely not, said West, although he had actually heard such a rumour himself.
The heir to the throne in harm's way when the king is in poor health? A ludicrous notion!
Burr got up, burping and wincing.
Damn his stomach!
He stalked over to the window and frowned out across the Agriont.
They think it will be easily settled, he said quietly. The closed council. A little jaunt in Angland, done with before the first snow falls, in spite of this shock with Dunbrecht.
They never learn.
They said the same about our war with the Gurkish, and that nearly finished us. These Northmen are not the primitives they think. I fought with northern mercenaries in Starikland, hard men used to hard lives, raised on warfare, fearless and stubborn, expert at fighting in the hills, in the forests, in the cold. They do not follow our rules, or even understand them. They will bring a violence and a savagery to the battlefield that would make a Gurkish blush.
Burr turned away from the window, back to West.
You were born in Angland, weren't you, Major?
Yes, sir, in the south, near Austenholm. My family's farm was there before my father died.
He trailed off. You were raised there?
Yes.
You know the land, then?
West frowned.
In that region, sir, but I've not been back for... Do you know these Northmen?
Some. There are still many living in Angland.
You speak their tongue?
Yes, a little, but they speak many.
Good. I'm putting together a staff. Good men I can rely on to carry out my orders and to see to it that this army of ours does not fall apart before it even comes into contact with the enemy.
Of course, sir.
West racked his brains. Captain Luthar is a capable and intelligent officer. Lieutenant Jellinholm.
Bah!
Shouted Burr, waving his hand in frustration. I know Luthar. The boy's a cretin. Just the sort of bright-eyed child that I was talking about. It's you I need, West.
Me?
Yes, you.
Marshal Varouz, the Union's most famous soldier, no less, has given you a glowing report. He says you are a most committed, tenacious, and hard-working officer, the very qualities I need. As a lieutenant, you fought in Gurkhal under Colonel Glockta, did you not?
West swallowed.
Well, yes. And it is well known you were first through the breach at Ulrioch. Well, among the first, I was... You have led men in the field, and your personal courage is beyond question. There is no need to be modest, Major. You are the man for me.
Burr sat back, a smile on his face, confident he had made his point. He burped again, holding up his hand.
My apologies. Damn indigestion.
Sir, may I be blunt?
I am no courtier, West. You must always be blunt with me. I demand it.
An appointment on a Lord Marshal's staff, sir. You must understand, I am a gentleman's son, a commoner. As commander of a battalion, I already have difficulty gaining the respect of the junior officers. The men I would have to give orders to if I were on your staff, sir, senior men, with good blood. He paused, exasperated. The marshal gazed blankly at him.
They will not permit it!
Burr's eyebrows drew together.
Permit it? Their pride will not allow it, sir. Damn their pride!
Burr leaned forward, his dark eyes fixed on West's face.
Now listen to me and listen carefully. Times are changing. I don't need men with good blood. I need men who can plan and organize, give orders and follow them. There will be no room in my army for those who cannot do as they are told. I don't care how noble they are. As a member of my staff, you represent me, and I will not be slighted or ignored.
He burped suddenly and smashed the table with his fist.
I will see to it, he roared. Times are changing. They may not smell it yet, but they soon will.
West stared dumbly back.
In any case, and Burr waved a dismissive hand, I am not consulting with you, I am informing you. This is your new assignment. Your king needs you, your country needs you, and that is all. You have 5 days to hand over command of your battalion.
And the Lord Marshal turned back to his papers.
Yes, sir, muttered West.
He fumbled the door shut behind him with numb fingers, walked slowly down the hallway, staring at the floor. War. War in the north. Dunbrecht fallen, the Northmen loose in Angland. Officers hurried around him. Someone brushed past, but he hardly noticed. There were people in danger, mortal danger. People he knew, maybe. Neighbors from home. There was fighting even now, inside the Union's borders. He rubbed his jaw. This war could be a terrible thing, worse than Gurkhal had been even, and he would be at the heart of it. A place on a Lord Marshal's staff. Him? Colum West? A commoner? He still could hardly believe it. West felt a sneaking, guilty glow of satisfaction. It was for just such an appointment that he had been working like a dog all these years. If he did well, there was no telling where he might go. This war was a bad thing, a terrible thing, no doubt. He felt himself grinning. A terrible thing. But it just might be the making of him. Chapter 23 The Theatrical Outfitters. The deck creaked and shifted beneath his feet, the sailcloth flapped gently, seabirds crowed and called in the salty air above.
I never thought to see such a thing, muttered Logan.
The city was a huge white crescent, stretching all round the wide blue bay, sprawling across many bridges, tiny in the distance, and onto rocky islands in the sea. Here and there, green parks stood out from the confusion of buildings, the thin grey lines of rivers and canals shone in the sun. There were walls, too, studded with towers, skirting the distant edge of the city and striking boldly through the jumble of houses. Logan's jaw hung stupidly open,
His eyes darted here and there, unable to take in the whole.
"Adua," murmured Baez. "The center of the world. The poets call her the City of White Towers. Beautiful, isn't she, from a distance?"
The Magus leaned towards him.
"Believe me, though, she stinks when you get close."
A vast fortress rose up from within the city, its sheer white walls towering above the carpet of buildings outside, bright sunlight glinting on shining domes within. Logan had never dreamed of a man-made thing so great, so proud, so strong. One tower in particular rose high, high over all the others, a tapering cluster of smooth, dark pillars seeming to support the very sky.
"And Bethod means to make war on this," he whispered. "He must be mad."
"Perhaps. Bethod, for all his waste and pride, understands the Union." Baez nodded towards the city.
"They are jealous of one another, all those people. It may be a union in name, but they fight each other tooth and nail. The lowly squabble over trifles, the great wage secret wars for power and wealth, and they call it government. Wars of words and tricks and guile, but no less bloody for that. The casualties are many."
The Magus sighed.
"Behind those walls they shout and argue and endlessly bite one another's backs. Old squabbles are never settled, but thrive and put down roots, and the roots grow deeper with the passing years. It has always been so. They are not like you, Logan. A man here can smile and fawn and call you friend, give you gifts with one hand, and stab you with the other. You will find this a strange place."
Logan already found it the strangest thing he had ever seen. There was no end to it. As their boat slipped into the bay, the city seemed to grow more vast than ever. A forest of white buildings, speckled with dark windows, embracing them on all sides, covering the hills in roofs and towers, crowding together, wall squashed to wall, pressing up against the water on the shoreline. Ships and boats of all designs vied with each other in the bay, sails billowing, crewmen crying out over the noise of the spray, hurrying about the decks and crawling through the rigging. Some were smaller even than their own little two-sailed boat. Some were far larger. Logan gawped, amazed, as a huge vessel ploughed through the water towards them, shining spray flying from its prow. A mountain of wood floating by some magic in the sea. The ship passed, leaving them rocking in its wake, but there were more, many more, tethered to the countless wharves along the shore. Logan, shielding his eyes against the bright sun with one hand, began to make out people on the sprawling docks. He began to hear them, too, a faint din of voices crying and carts rattling and cargoes clattering to the ground. There were hundreds of tiny figures swarming among the ships and buildings like black ants.
"How many live here?" he whispered.
"Thousands,"
Baez shrugged. "Hundreds of thousands. People from every land within the circle of the world. There are Northmen here and dark-skinned Cantics from Gurkul and beyond. People from the old empire, far to the west, and merchants of the free cities of Styria. Others, too, from still further away, the Thousand Islands, distant Suljuk, and Thond, where they worship the sun. More people than can be counted, living, dying, working, breeding, climbing one upon the other. Welcome!"
And Baez spread his arms wide to encompass the monstrous, the beautiful, the endless city.
"To civilization." Hundreds of thousands.
Logan struggled to understand it.
Hundreds of thousands. Could there be so many people in the world?
He stared at the city all around him, wondering, rubbing his aching eyes. what might 100,000 people look like? An hour later, he knew. Only in battle had Logan ever been so squashed, hemmed, pressed by other people. It was like a battle, here on the docks. The cries, the anger, the crush, the fear and confusion. A battle in which no mercy was shown, and which had no end and no winners. Logan was used to the open sky, the air around him, his own company. On the road, when Baez and Kwai had ridden close beside him, he'd felt squeezed. Now there were people on every side, pushing, jostling, shouting. Hundreds of them. Thousands. Hundreds of thousands. Could they really all be people? People like him, with thoughts and moods and dreams? Faces loomed up and flashed by, surly, anxious, frowning, gone in a sickening whirl of colour. Logan swallowed, blinked. His throat was painfully dry, his head span. Surely this was hell. He knew he deserved to be here, but he didn't remember dying.
Malachus,
he hissed desperately. The apprentice looked round.
Stop a moment.
Logan pulled at his collar, trying to let some air in.
I can't breathe.
Kwai grinned.
It might just be the smell.
It might at that. The docks smelled like hell and no mistake. The reek of stinking fish, sickly spices, rotting fruit, fresh dung, sweating horses and mules and people mingled and bred under the hot sun and became worse by far than any one alone.
Move!
A shoulder knocked Logan roughly aside and was gone. He leaned against a grimy wall and wiped sweat from his face. Baez was smiling.
Not like the wide and barren north, eh, Nine Fingers?
No.
Logan watched the people milling past, the horses, the carts, the endless faces. A man stared suspiciously at him as he passed. A boy pointed at him and shouted something. A woman with a basket gave him a wide berth, staring fearfully up as she hurried by. Now he had a moment to think. They were all looking and pointing and staring, and they didn't look happy. Logan leaned down to Malachus.
I am feared and hated throughout the north. I don't like it, but I know why.
A sullen group of sailors stared at him with hard eyes, muttering to each other under their breath. He watched them, puzzled, until they disappeared behind a rumbling wagon.
Why do they hate me here?
Bethod has moved quickly,
muttered Baez, frowning out at the crowds.
His war with the Union has already begun. We will not find the North too popular in Adua, I fear.
How do they know where I'm from?
Malachus raised an eyebrow.
You stick out somewhat.
Logan flinched as a pair of laughing youths flashed by him.
I do? Among all this?
Only like a huge, scarred, dirty gatepost.
Ah.
He looked down at himself.
I see.
Away from the docks, the crowds grew sparser, the air cleaner, the noise faded. It was still teeming, stinking, and noisy, but at least Logan could take a breath. They passed across wide paved squares, decorated with plants and statues, where brightly painted wooden signs hung over doors. Blue fish, pink pigs, purple bunches of grapes, brown loaves of bread. There were tables and chairs out in the sun, where people sat and ate from flat pots, drank from green glass cups. They threaded through narrow alleys, where rickety-looking wood and plaster buildings leaned out over them, almost meeting above their heads, leaving only a thin strip of blue sky between. They wandered down wide, cobbled roads, busy with people and lined with monstrous white buildings. Logan blinked and gaped at all of it. On no moor, however foggy, in no forest, however dense, had Logan ever felt so completely lost. He had no idea now in what direction the boat was, though they'd left it no more than half an hour ago. The sun was hidden behind the towering buildings,
and everything looked the same. He was terrified he'd lose track of Baez and Kwai in the crowds and be lost forever. He hurried after the back of the wizard's bald head, following him into an open space. A great road, bigger than any they'd seen so far, bounded on either side by white palaces behind high walls and fences lined with ancient trees. The people here were different. Their clothes were bright and gaudy, cut in strange styles that served no purpose. The women hardly seemed like people at all, pale and bony, swaddled in shining fabric, flapping at themselves in the hot sun with pieces of cloth stretched over sticks.
"Where are we?"
he shouted at Baez. If the wizard had answered that they were on the moon, Logan would not have been surprised.
"This is the Middle Way, one of the city's main thoroughfares. It cuts through the very center of the city to the Agriont."
"Agriont?
Fortress, palace, barracks, seat of government. A city within the city, the heart of the Union. That's where we're going."
"We are?" A group of sour young men stared suspiciously at Logan as he passed them.
"Will they let us in?"
"Oh, yes. But they won't like it." Logan struggled on through the crowds. Everywhere the sun twinkled on the panes of glass windows, hundreds of them. Carleon had a few glass windows in the grandest buildings, at least before they'd sacked the city. Precious few afterwards, it had to be admitted. Precious little of anything. The dogman had loved the sound the glass made as it broke. He'd prodded at the windows with a spear, a great big smile on his face, delighted by the crash and tinkle. That had hardly been the worst of it. Bethod had given the city to his carles for 3 days. That was his custom, and they loved him for it. Logan had lost his finger in the battle the day before, and they'd closed the wound with hot iron. It throbbed and throbbed, and the pain had made him savage, as though he'd needed an excuse for violence back then. He remembered the stink of blood and sweat and smoke, the sounds of screaming and crashing and laughter.
"Please."
Logan tripped, nearly fell. There was something clinging to his leg. A woman sitting on the ground beside a wall. Her clothes were dirty, ragged. Her face was pale, pinched with hunger. She had something in her arms, a bundle of rags, a child.
"Please."
Nothing else. The people laughed and chattered and surged around them, just as if they weren't there.
"Please."
"I don't have anything," he muttered. No more than 5 strides away, a man in a tall hat sat at a table and chuckled with a friend as he tucked into a steaming plate of meat and vegetables. Logan blinked at the plate of food, at the starving woman.
"Logan, come on!"
Baez had taken him by the elbow and was drawing him away.
"But shouldn't we? Haven't you noticed? They're everywhere. The king needs money, so he squeezes the nobles. The nobles squeeze their tenants, the tenants squeeze the peasants. Some of them, the old, the weak, the extra sons and daughters, they get squeezed right out the bottom. Too many mouths to feed. The lucky ones make thieves or whores, the rest end up begging.
But clear the road!" Logan stumbled to the wall and pressed himself against it, Malachus and Baez beside him. The crowds parted, and a long column of men tramped by, shepherded by armored guards. Some were young, mere boys. Some were very old. All were dirty and ragged, and few of them looked healthy. A couple were clearly lame, hobbling along as best they could. One near the front had only one arm. A passerby in a fabulous crimson jacket held a square of cloth over his wrinkled nose as the beggars shuffled past.
"What are these?" Logan whispered to Baez. "Lawbreakers?"
The Magus chuckled.
"Soldiers."
Logan stared at them, filthy, coughing, limping, some without boots.
"Soldiers? These?"
"Oh, yes. They go to fight Bethod.
Logan rubbed at his temples. A clan once sent their poorest warrior, a man called Forley the Weakest, to fight me in a duel. They meant it by way of surrender. Why does this union send their weakest? Logan shook his head grimly. They won't beat Bethod with such as these. They will send others. Baez pointed out another smaller gathering. Those are soldiers, too. Those. A group of tall youths dressed in gaudy suits of red or bright green cloth, a couple with outsized hats. They were at least wearing swords, of a kind, but they hardly looked like fighting men. Fighting women, maybe. Logan frowned, staring from one group to the other. The dirty beggars, the gaudy lads. It was hard for him to say which were the stranger. A tiny bell jingled as the door opened, and Logan followed Baez through the low archway, Malachus behind him. The shop was dim after the bright street, and it took Logan's eyes a moment to adjust. Leaning against a wall were sheets of wood, childishly daubed with pictures of buildings, forests, mountains. Strange clothes were draped over stands beside them, flowing robes, lurid gowns, suits of armor, enormous hats and helmets, rings and jewelry, even a heavy crown. Weapons occupied a small rack, swords and spears richly decorated. Logan stepped closer, frowning. They were fakes. Nothing was real. The weapons were painted wood. The crown was made of flaking tin. The jewels were colored glass. What is this place? Baez was casting an eye over the robes by the wall. A theatrical outfitter's. A what? The people of this city love spectacle, comedy, drama, theatre of all kinds. This shop provides equipment for the mounting of plays. Stories. Logan poked at a wooden sword. Some people have too much time on their hands. A small, plump man emerged from a door at the back of the shop, looking Baez, Malachus, and Logan over suspiciously. "Can I help you, gentlemen?" "Of course." Baez stepped forward, switching effortlessly to the common tongue. "We are mounting a production and require some costumes. We understand you are the foremost theatrical outfitters in all of Adua." The shopkeeper smiled nervously, taking in their grimy faces and travel-stained clothes. "True, true, but, quality is expensive, gentlemen." "Money is no object." Baez took out a bulging purse and tossed it absently on the counter. It sagged open, heavy golden coins scattering across the wood. The shopkeeper's eyes lit with an inner fire.
"Of course. What precisely did you have in mind?"
"I need a magnificent robe suitable for a magus, or a great sorcerer, or some such. Something of the arcane about it, certainly. Then we'll have something similar, if less impressive, for an apprentice. Finally, we need something for a mighty warrior, a prince of the distant north. Something with fur, I imagine?"
"Those should be straightforward. I will see what we have."
The shopkeeper disappeared through the door behind the counter.
"What is all this shit?" asked Logan.
The wizard grinned. "People are born to their station here. They have commoners to fight and farm the land and do the work. They have gentry to trade and build and do the thinking. They have nobility to own the land and push the others around. They have royalty." Baez glanced at the tin crown.
"I forget exactly why. In the north, you can rise as high as your merits will take you. Only look at our mutual friend Bethod. Not so here. A man is born in his place and is expected to stay there. We must seem to be from a high place indeed if we are to be taken seriously. Dressed as we are, we wouldn't get past the gates of the Agriont."
The shopkeeper interrupted him by reappearing through the door, his arms heaped with bright cloth.
One mystical robe, suitable for the most powerful of wizards. Used last year for a Juvens in a production of The End of the Empire during the Spring Festival. It is, if I may say so, some of my best work.
Byers held the shimmering swathe of crimson cloth up to the faint light, gazing at it admiringly. Arcane diagrams, mystical lettering, and symbols of sun, moon, and stars glittered in silver thread. Malachus ran a hand over the shining cloth of his own absurd garment.
"I don't think you'd have laughed me off so quickly, eh, Logan, if I'd arrived at your campfire dressed in this?"
Logan winced.
"I reckon I might have."
"And here we have a splendid piece of barbarian garb." The shopkeeper hefted a black leather tunic onto the counter, set with swirls of shiny brass, trimmed with pointless tissues of delicate chainmail. He pointed at the matching fur cloak. "This is real sable." It was a ludicrous piece of clothing, equally useless for warmth or protection. Logan folded his arms across his old coat.
"You think I'm going to wear that?"
The shopkeeper swallowed nervously.
"You must forgive my friend," said Byers. "He is an actor after the new fashion. He believes in losing himself entirely in his role."
"Is that so?" squeaked the man, looking Logan up and down.
"Northmen are, I suppose, topical?"
"Absolutely. I do declare Master Ninefingers is the very best at what he does." The old wizard nudged Logan in the ribs.
"The very best. I have seen it."
"If you say so." The shopkeeper looked far from convinced.
"Might I inquire what you will be staging?"
"Oh, it's a new piece." Byers tapped the side of his bald head with a finger. "I am still working on the details."
"Really?"
"Indeed. More a scene than an entire play." He glanced back at the robe, admiring the way the light glittered on the arcane symbols. "A scene in which Byers, the first of the Magi, finally takes up his seat on the closed council."
"Ah," the shopkeeper nodded knowingly. "A political piece, a biting satire, perhaps? Will it be comic or dramatic in tone?"
Byers glanced sidelong at Logan. "That remains to be seen." Chapter 24 Barbarians at the Gate. Giselle flashed along the lane beside the moat, feet pounding on the worn cobblestones, the great white wall sliding endlessly by on his right, one tower after another, as he made his daily circuit of the Agriont. Since he had cut down on the drinking, the improvement in his stamina had been impressive. He was scarcely even out of breath. It was early, and the streets of the city were nearly empty. The odd person would look up at him as he ran by, maybe even call out some word of encouragement, but Giselle barely noticed them. His eyes were fixed on the sparkling, lapping water in the moat, and his mind was elsewhere. Ardi. Where else was it ever? He had supposed, after that day when West had warned him off, after he had stopped seeing her, that his thoughts would soon return to other matters, and other women. He had applied himself to his fencing with a will, attempted to show an interest in his duties as an officer, but he found himself unable to concentrate, and other women seemed now pale, flat, tedious creatures. The long runs, the monotonous exercises with bar and beam, gave his mind ample opportunity to wander. The tedium of peacetime soldiering was even worse, reading boring papers, standing guard on things that needed no guarding. His attention would inevitably slip, and then she would be there. Ardi in wholesome peasant garb, flushed and sweaty from hard work in the fields. Ardi in the finery of a princess, glittering with jewels. Ardi bathing in forest pools while he watched from the bushes. Ardi proper and demure, glancing shyly up at him from beneath her lashes. Ardi a whore by the docks, beckoning to him from a grimy doorway. The fantasies were infinite in variety, but they all ended the same way. His hour-long circuit of the Agriant was complete, and he thumped across the bridge and back in through the south gate. Giselle treated the guards to their daily share of indifference.